I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. This hour, our guest wrote a very interesting piece in the current issue of Harper's, The Watchman, What Became of the Christian Intellectuals. Alan Jacobs writes about how American pundits and political junkies are struggling to come to terms with some alarming developments with the Republican nominee calling for a ban on Muslim immigration to the U.S. and the construction of a war along the Mexican border. He highlights what's going on with the rise of the French right, Germany buzzing with possibility of backlash against Angela Merkel's openness to Middle Eastern refugees, also far-right parties appearing in the Netherlands, Poland, and liberal Northern European countries. And so he looks at what happened. Half a century ago, we had intellectuals who existed, and it was mostly in the lead up to World War II and during the war, serious Christian intellectuals who occupied a prominent place on the national stage. They were even on the cover of Time magazine. They wrote a lot of books. They were featured prominently. They're gone now. Why did they disappear? Who were they? A lot of the article explores that. Where did they go, and will they return? So it should be an interesting conversation. Our guest is Alan Jacobs. Alan is Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the Honors Program at Baylor University. He's the author of the Book of Common Prayer, a biography, and he's also at work right now on a book that will be published next year, which sounds fascinating, How to Think, A Guide for the Perplexed. We'll touch on that during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Alan Jacobs, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Why don't you talk in a little more detail? You start your article with what's been going on with the rise of Trump in this country and what's been going on in other countries. Give us an overview of what exactly is happening.
Well, I think what's happening right now is the rise, you've mentioned the rise of these far-right or, in some cases, nationalist and, in some cases, nativist kinds of political forces, and by no means all of those are religious in orientation, mm-hmm. but a lot of them are. And they're speaking a language that modern, liberal, secular folks tend not to understand. And there's also, I think, modern, liberal, secular folks tend to speak a language that those people don't understand very well either. And so I'm distressed by the extent to which we have groups in our society in America, but also in the rest of the world, who just can't even understand one another, much less come to any kind of agreement. And that got me thinking about how there used to be this kind of familiar figure. You know, they would turn up in the magazines and in the early days of television, and you'd hear them on the radio, and they were quoted in newspapers or wrote op-eds for the newspapers, who were the people who kind of bridged the gap between religious communities and the larger society. They would sort of go back and forth between the two. And to religious people, they would say, in many cases, they wouldn't always say this, but they would often say something like, now, you know, don't be so afraid of liberal secular society. It's not as dangerous as you think it is. These people don't mean you harm. And then they would come to the liberal secular society and say the same thing. These Christians, these religious people, they're not as crazy as you may think. Let me try to explain them to you. And I think that was a tremendously valuable service to society. It's always good, I think, when you have people who can bridge the gap between two different communities who don't understand one another very well. But I think when religious issues are at stake, then that becomes all the more important. And in America, I think we tend to have the problem of Christian communities who don't understand the larger world and are misunderstood by it. In Europe, it might be much more relevant to have a Muslim intellectual who could do this kind of work. Mm-hmm. And there are people who do that, Tariq Ramadan and people like that. But we could always use more of them to serve as those kinds of mediators between the different communities.
You take us through a fascinating history of the Christian intellectual prior to World War II, mm-hmm. and say that that intellectual was a product of World War II. Tell me about some of those people, and were they essentially trying to understand a rise of the Nazis?
They were, and of totalitarian movements in general, but you can't really understand them, and I promise I won't give you too much of a backstory here, but I want to commend a book by a colleague of mine, Philip Jenkins, who's written a book about religion in World War I. It's called The Great and Holy War, and if you look at that book, it's really horrifying to see how in England and in Germany and in France and everywhere, the intellectuals, the learned elite of the society, the cultural elite, they were all enthusiastic cheerleaders for the war. They were absolutely convinced that God was on the side of their nation. And I think that in the years after World War I, there were a lot of Christian thinkers who looked at that and said, oh, that was a disaster. You know, we were simply pack horses for nationalism and for war. We have to be more critical than that. We have to be more reflective. We have to be able to stand back from nationalist impulses. And so by the time World War II rolled around, I think you had a new generation of Christian intellectuals who were willing to be more critical. So here's one example.
Okay.
C.S. Lewis, when 10 days into the war, he went to church, and the pastor of his church had a prayer, and the prayer was, "Prosper, O Lord, our righteous cause." And Lewis was extremely critical, both directly to the pastor and then also in his public writings, by saying, how do we know our cause is righteous? You know, it's not righteous just because it's ours.
Mm-hmm.
What we should do instead is to, you know, pray for our enemies. Isn't that something that we're supposed to do? And so this idea that it was important for a Christian to stand aside a little bit from patriotism and not always just be a cheerleader for the patriotic voices, but instead to have a somewhat detached and somewhat critical perspective, that became very important in World War II, and you saw it on both sides of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Lewis is an example. In America, I think Reinhold Niebuhr was to some extent fit in that camp, though I think sometimes he was a little too caught up in the national enterprise at times. And there was a whole body of people for whom it was absolutely essential to come up with a critical and thoughtful, not necessarily pacifist, though some of them were pacifists. Dorothy Day, for instance, the great leader of the Catholic worker movement in New York, remained pacifist throughout the war, but she always insisted that being a pacifist didn't mean that you weren't patriotic. It's just that you have a higher call than that of the nation. So that's the context, and I think those people really it was a very useful service that they performed by, without being hostile to their society, nevertheless being to some degree critical of the way that it went about its business.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this interesting time, and you tell the story of W.H. Auden going to Harvard mm-hmm. University and giving a speech. Mm-hmm. He had emphasized, you write, throughout the war, in both poetry and prose, the need for a theologically based understanding of the global conflict. So he goes to Harvard, where the president of Harvard is a chemist who is captivated by the techno-utopian mood of the era. So is it fair to say that what we have happening here is the justification for World War II, looking at the Christian intellectual moral case here, as opposed to whether or not we're going to win the war because of our superior technology, and so we see a break?
That's exactly right. And in fact, lots and lots of people were worried about this in World War II, not just Christians. There were lots of people who had no religious belief whatsoever who were very concerned that the Allies were falling, in all of the Allied nations were falling into a kind of a might makes right point of view that, yes, of course our culture is superior because look how we're winning the war. And the closer they got to victory, the louder those voices became, and the more important it became for society to hear voices of people who are saying, well, not necessarily, that, you know, it's not always the case that might makes right. And sometimes the more righteous cause is the one that loses. And so let's not get caught up in pride in our own technological and military accomplishments. This is why Reinhold Niebuhr was, I don't think he coined this phrase, but he used the phrase often, that it would do us little good to win the war if we lose the peace. And by losing the peace, he meant becoming a society that didn't care about anything except its own power.
Mm-hmm.
And it lost its kind of moral center and its moral concern. So that's what he was concerned about. And I think that's what all these figures were concerned
mm-hmm.
about.
Now, some of the movements, though, and tell me the difference here, were not just Christian intellectuals. There were people who were secularists. There were many people who wouldn't define themselves as Christian. There were a lot of Jewish leaders of some of these movements. What was the difference? What's the difference between those kinds of let's take everybody in to our cause and a Christian yeah. intellectual movement? Were there a couple of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were several, and one of the real arguments that went on, like for instance, in America, one of the most interesting groups to deal with these matters was a conference on science and religion and the American way of life. It has a name a mile long that was created by Rabbi Louis Finkelstein, who was the head of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. And one of the ongoing debates that he had with other people who were working with him in these conferences was, well, do we invite people who don't have any particular religious beliefs? And Finkelstein was of the view, well, let's hear from people from all different points of view. But there were other, both Christian and Jewish thinkers who worked along with him who said, no, if you don't have some sort of firm, clear religious belief, then you can't resist the Nazis. You know, their arguments are going to be more powerful than yours, and they will compel people through the intensity of their belief, and we can't fight them unless we have equally strong beliefs. And so these people would tell Finkelstein, don't invite Sidney Hook, who was a prominent political philosopher. He's an atheist. Don't invite John Dewey, one of the most famous intellectuals in America at the time. He doesn't believe in anything. And Finkelstein was spending a lot of time trying to figure out, How do we balance this? You know, he as a Jew believed that religious voices needed to have a prominent place in this conversation, but he didn't know whether there should be only religious voices in his little group. And eventually, this all got so heated that he took the group private and just no longer had public conferences, so that they could try to sort things out in less. In a less public and open way.
Mm-hmm. You also mention some of these thinkers, intellectuals, being very much omnipresent in American society, on the cover of Time magazine, publishing
right.
books that a lot of people read. Isn't that mm-hmm. different than what we are encountering today? It just is in so many ways.
It is. It's very different. And a lot of my article is about trying to trace how that happened. And I think obviously America was a much more there were a much higher percentage of Christians in America then than there are now. But there's still, America is an unusually religious nation in comparison to all the other Western nations. Its rate of religious belief and participation is definitely declining, but from a much, much higher percentage than in Europe. And it's somewhat odd that a nation with as many religious believers as America has, and of course, many American religious believers are not Christian. They believe in other religions, as obviously. But a nation that's as religious as America doesn't have that many really prominent religious voices in the mainstream of the society. And I think a lot of Christians in particular will say, well, you know, that's anti-Christian prejudice. But I actually don't think there is anti-Christian prejudice among the cultural elite to some degree, but I don't think that's the main problem. I think the main problem, and I try to explain this in the article, is that Christians decided in the years after World War II to build up their own institutions, to build up their own publishing houses and magazines and colleges and universities. I teach at a Christian university, Baylor University, and the more attention you devote to building up your own institutions as a religious community, the less time and energy and resources you have for trying to communicate with the larger society, and that's the paradox.
The first person who comes to mind post-World War II, who certainly was a Christian intellectual and had a huge influence on highlighting very important issues on race in this country, is Dr. Martin Luther King. Wasn't he a strong Christian intellectual?
Yeah. So this is where I want to say something really important. I'm using in this article a particular definition of the term intellectual.
Okay.
And that's one that comes from the sociologist Carl Mannheim. And he really emphasizes the intellectual as being somebody who stands by and watches. That's why the article is called The Watchman.
Hmm.
You know, somebody who stands by and watches. The intellectual in Mannheim's definition is by definition not an activist. The intellectual is kind of standing apart from things a little bit. And so to say that someone is an intellectual is not to pay them a compliment. And to say that someone isn't, in Mannheim's sense, is not to insult their intelligence, right? You could be the most intelligent person imaginable and yet not be an intellectual in Mannheim's sense, because you're not having that withdrawn, detached role. So I don't think that there was a more intellectually gifted Christian in the second half of the 20th century than Martin Luther King Jr. I think he was a brilliant man, but his primary role was not to stand aside and interpret. His primary role in society was to be an activist, to change things, to lead the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to preach in churches, to be out there as a change agent of the first order. So when I leave him out of my group, it's not meant in any way to denigrate his intellectual abilities, which were enormous, but rather to say he had a somewhat different role to play than these more detached figures.
Well, let's talk more about what that role is, because what is the role of being detached from this, being able to analyze all sides on this rather than being an activist who's marching in the streets?
I think to some extent, yeah. You know, there's a famous Marxist line from Karl Marx. The point is not to understand the world. The point is to change it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the intellectual is the person who says, well, hold on. Let's make sure we understand it first so that we can change it appropriately. And so the intellectual in this sense, you know, doesn't have an organization to lead, doesn't have a particular investment in sustaining something. That's why, I mean, similarly, just as I would say that in Mannheim's sense, Dr. King is not primarily an intellectual, neither can a pope, for instance, no matter how brilliant, be an intellectual, because a pope is leading an institution and has to make that institution healthy and strong. That's the responsibility that he has. So I think the more involved you are in the institution and making that institution succeed, the harder it is to be detached. And so the reason that people listened to, or one of the reasons that people listened to those intellectuals in the 50s, 40s and 50s, decliningly, I think, but they listened to them in part because they thought, oh, they don't have an axe to grind. They don't have a horse in the race.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be more fair-minded and more balanced. And that was where their social authority came from.
So who is fair-minded? I want to get to phone calls here in a moment. Who is fair-minded and giving us a strong intellect in trying to analyze what's going on with Donald Trump and Le Pen and what's happening with... Who's giving us that understanding?
I think that that's largely missing today.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there aren't enough people. Let me make a little bit of a distinction here, right? There's a lot of Trump supporters who don't have any particular religious commitments at all. And a lot of the people who support Trump and who say, I'm an evangelical, actually are people who don't have much of a record of church attendance. They're not very much involved in their religious communities. And so that's a little bit hard to assess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in, so you might not need a Christian intellectual who would be able to make sense of these communities. Some of your listeners may have come across this recent book by J.D. Vance called Hillbilly Elegy.
Yeah, we're going to talk. I haven't read it yet, but I know a lot about it.
Yeah, and Vance happens to be a Christian, I think, but he doesn't speak as a Christian. That's not his primary emphasis. He's someone who wants to say, I grew up in this community. I grew up in the world of people who support Donald Trump, and here's how they think. And I think that that's incredibly valuable. What would be really great is to have someone who says, I've talked to a lot of Christians who support Donald Trump, and here's how they think. And I believe you have some people who can do that, but they don't have a necessarily prominent place on the national stage. You know, their voices, they don't have a really big megaphone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all, I think that's the problem for Christians now. It's really hard to speak as a Christian in a way that is widely audible within our media world.
The person who comes to mind, and you write about him, is Cornel West.
Yeah, yeah. And West is this goes back to the Dr. King thing, because West is a real borderline case. Because on the one hand, he's clearly an intellectual. He is someone who has written many, many books that are seriously academic, seriously intellectual, trying to understand the roots of race in America and the pathologies associated with race in America. But he's also someone who has been very active and someone who has been, he's involved in protests and he's led marches, and he's really a borderline figure. And one of the things that I think is a little bit sad is that the more of an activist you are, the harder it is for people to hear you as an intellectual. And the more of an intellectual, the more of that explanatory role you have, the harder it is to function as a real change agent, as someone who is really trying to transform things. So it's a hard role. And for people like Dr. King and Cornel West, it's difficult to figure out where to place the primary energies that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real struggle.
What are you?
Well, I mean, I'm an English professor, a humanities professor, basically. I don't have this is as public as I get. You know, I'm on public radio.
Yes, you are.
That's as public as I get, you know. So I don't have that kind of voice. And I think for me, I don't especially want it. I'm much, much more comfortable just sitting in my room and writing. and I think you have to have a pretty high tolerance for being out there in the public eye in order. I mean, somebody like Reinhold Niebuhr, he loved it. He loved it. He was like, yeah, put me out there in front of everybody, you know.
You got a talk show, I'll be on it. Right. Okay.
Yeah. I can't do that. I'm just not wired that way.
Ellen Jacobs is our guest this hour, author of the piece in Harper's this month, The Watchman, What Became of the Christian Intellectuals. He is a distinguished professor of the humanities in the honors program at Baylor University, is the author of the Book of Common. He's the author of all kinds of books and essays, most recently The Book of Common Prayer, a biography, and he's at work right now on a book that will be titled How to Think, A Guide for the Perplexed. He says over the past few years, he's become saddened by the conditions of the public sphere. It's become a morass of bile, invective, deliberate and accidental misunderstanding, mistrust of neighbors. He is grieved by all of this, and he has thought about two things particularly. The first is that many of our fiercest disputes occur because the people involved simply are not thinking. It's a book about thinking. Does that sound really interesting? All right, let's go to you, and here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook, where we always like to receive your messages, and if you like us there, you'll know about upcoming shows, so you can look forward to certain programs. That's the Kathleen Dent Show. To you, in a minute, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. Let's go to Bob in River Falls first. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Hi. This is going to take just a second. What I want to say first is that when I, in the early 70s, I went to a liberal Lutheran church, ALC, American Lutheran Church, and our confirmation class was taught by a preacher who was practically a professor. He had multiple degrees in various things. And he taught us about H. Richard Niebuhr. We read essays like by Rudolf Bultmann, such as You Are Accepted. We studied Bonhoeffer's Letters and Papers from Prison, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we went to these little camps up north at the church synod owned up on a lake, and where we would discuss this theological stuff. And it was really cool. Now, the thing I want to mention is a lot of times people associate maturity of thinking with atheism or your religion. And I think that when the megaphone that you talked about had been in was blasting through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and zeros by Pat Robertson and the Falwell and all that, it kind of distorted things. And the disappearance of liberation theology, where you had, like, Hans Kuhn, his book was a bestseller for a while in the 90s, I think, or 80s.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are disappearing. And one of the things is that I think that with the particular church that I went to was eventually taken over by fundamentalists who split over gay rights, having gays in the congregation. And I went a year and a half where it was taken over by this right-wing group, and it was eventually split, and the courts gave it back to the original congregants.
Yeah, I'm going to have to hold you there, Bob. You have a really bad phone line. I'm sorry. If you can get a better phone line, we can listen to you further, but you've given us food for thought here. Alan?
Yeah, well, I mean, Bob is raising a lot of really interesting issues there, and I could. It has many different handles. His comment does. Let me just take one. One of the things that a really important book that was published in the early 60s was by a political philosopher named Richard Hofstadter, and it's called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, and I think Hofstadter explains really forcefully and clearly and incontrovertibly the kind of declining interest of Americans in the intellectual life, and the lack of respect for intellectual inquiry as something that was of real social value. And I think that Christians caught that anti-intellectual bug maybe more virulently than almost anyone else. And so one of the things that's happened is that churches have ceased to, not ceased, but churches do not nearly as often today as perhaps in an earlier generation think of intellectual formation as something that they want for their, especially their young people to have. So you're not going to have very many churches that would go through confirmation, put teenagers through confirmation while having them read the sorts of things that Bob read. Because I think the fear is that nobody's going to enjoy that, and there are many more entertaining things to do online. and so they don't want to do anything that would chase people further away. So we're in kind of a negative feedback loop here, where I think it's Christians are in general less and less well prepared to engage with the ideas that drive the larger society, which means that then why should the larger society want to hear what Christians have to say? They're not bringing anything of value to the table.
Mm.
And then they are dismissive towards Christians, and then Christians get more resentful, and then that's the feedback loop. And I really am concerned about how strong that feedback loop is, and not altogether sure what to do to try to reverse it.
Tell me how you have to. I'm not sure even what it means to be an intellectual or a Christian intellectual. What do you have to know to be calling yourself an intellectual?
Yeah, I you know, it is again, I don't want to think of it as a compliment, but rather as a role. And it's a role that people can play well or can play badly. And that's not true only within the religious orbit. If you take somebody from outside the religious orbit, or largely, not wholly outside it, but largely outside it, you take a guy like Glenn Beck, Now, not nearly as prominent a player in American life as he was a decade ago. But Glenn Beck was the guy who was going to explain things to you. You know, he was famous on his when his television show was widely watched. You know, he was famous for bringing out whiteboards and drawing, you know, diagrams on the whiteboards that would explain how society works, you know. And he was playing the role of the intellectual. He was saying, here's the knowledge. Here's how this, you want to understand this world that we're in. Here's how you understand it. Now, what I would say about Glenn Beck is that he was a really bad intellectual. He wasn't, he didn't know the stuff he needed to know. And what he did, what he had read, he didn't understand very well. But I don't think he was great at it. I don't think he's great at it today. But I think that was the role that he was trying to play. So, that's how I prefer to think of it, is in terms of having a particular role. And most communities, religious communities, political communities, communities that are brought together in other kinds of social goods, they kind of have their intellectuals. They have the people who are the explainers, the ones who are, you know, trusted to read and study and think and make sense of things and then come back and explain to other people how it goes. Mm.
Thanks, Bob, very much for your call. We go to Kay in Madison next. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering whether Thomas Merton would be someone that you would consider a Christian intellectual.
Yeah, that's another, you know, really wonderful kind of you know, marginal case. Merton, first of all, was one of the most, in the 1940s and 50s, he was one of the most famous Christians in America. And his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, was, I think, if not the best-selling, one of the very best-selling books of 1948. And it's the story of how he decided to enter monastery. And I think Merton himself was cautioning against at least a certain model of the intellectual life. And wanted to, his example was of somebody whom being an intellectual had done damage to. And he needed to submit himself to the discipline and authority of the church and especially of his monastic community in order to find his way in life and to be healed. So I think what Merton tended to, though he could speak this way because he was so smart. He was learned. He was a wonderful writer. He was artistically gifted. But his primary message is those things don't matter so much. He had one of his friends said to him, that he thought, and he was actually quoting another Christian source. This friend was not a Christian, but said to Merton, what do you want to do with your life? And Merton said, well, I don't know. I want to do this. I want to do that. And his friend said, you should want to be a saint. That's what you should want to do. That's the only thing that really matters. And that just really hit home to Merton. And he began to realize the extent to which some of his intellectual pursuits were for him getting in the way of pursuing sainthood. He didn't think they were bad, and he didn't think they were wrong, and he didn't think people should turn away from them. But one of the real emphases of Merton's work is putting the intellectual life in its place, which is not the highest place. So I see him as someone who was more of an advocate for traditional Christian practices, especially the practices of the contemplative life. I think that was his real calling, was to tell people the contemplative life is the highest form of life and more of you ought to be pursuing it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Great question.
Yeah, it is. Kate, thanks so much for your call. What about Pope Francis?
Well, again, he is someone, you know, very smart man, and his temperament is not as intellectual as that of his predecessor, Pope Benedict. He does seem to be more of an activist. But in any case, when you're Pope, you know, you don't get to just sit back and explain. You have to be an advocate. You have to be someone who speaks on behalf of your institution. You know, that this church is the bride of Christ. This church is God's church on earth. And here's, you know, why it matters, and here's why you should pay attention. And I think that that kind of advocacy is something that is not wholly compatible with the intellectual life as Carl Mannheim describes it.
Thanks, Key, for your call. We go to Paul in Merrill. Hello, Paul.
Hello. My question at its bottom is going to be about Walter Rauschenbusch. But in order to get there, I want to ask your guest whether he knew Professor James Veninga, who also taught at Baylor.
I do not.
Okay, well, he is since deceased, but he wrote a long essay called Can Religion Help Revive the Progressive Tradition? In a book called A Whole Which is Greater, Why the Wisconsin Uprising Failed. Mm-hmm. And the reason here for the why the Wisconsin Uprising failed is that Veninga's essay has to do in large part with Walter Rauschenbusch and his social gospel writings and teachings, of course, in the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, but also trying to put our current governor, Scott Walker, in that perspective of the Baptist denomination, because, of course, Walker is a Baptist, and so was Rauschenbusch. And so Veninga, in his essay here, Can Religion Help Revive the Progressive Tradition, is basically puzzled over how you can have a Baptist tradition with such an authority as Walter Rauschenbusch in it and yet end up with a politician like Scott Walker.
Those are excellent and vital issues as well. I've only been at Baylor for 3 years, so there's a lot that has gone on here historically that I don't necessarily know about. But the Rauschenbusch is a great example, right? Rauschenbusch was a theologian. He's an interesting figure. He was, I think, someone who was speaking within the church and to the church, not only by any means, but if I can make a distinction, rather than being the Christian intellectual of the kind that arose in World War II, Rauschenbusch was a more lasting kind of figure, a public theologian, a person who was doing theology and doing it in public. Speaking to the church, speaking from the church, because he was a pastor, but willing to have people who were unsure of their beliefs or who were sure that they didn't believe in the Christian message listen to him. Here's a really interesting thing about Rauschenbusch. So that's his most famous book is The Theology of the Social Gospel. At the end of my article, I speak about the philosopher Richard Rorty, who died just a few years ago. And Rorty is the best-known advocate for what in philosophy is called American pragmatism, in which he says, this is a reductive, but, you know, we don't have much time here, but Rorty says that the primary job of philosophy is not to help us understand the way the world really is, to be a kind of mirror of nature or a mirror of the world. The job of philosophy is to help us get what we want. And he says it's not really about truth. And he's not interested in truth claims. He's about how do we get towards a better society. And so for him, you know, he says, I actually heard Rorty say one time, the theists can talk, they want to. Somebody asked him about religion. He said, the theists, the religious believers can talk, but we don't have to listen. Now, why do I mention Rorty in this case? Because he is Walter Rauschenbusch's grandson. He is the grandson of the great proponent of the social gospel. And Rorty came to believe that he wanted to pursue, he wanted to continue to follow his grandfather's vision of changing American society so that it was more just, so that the poor were no longer so afflicted, so that racism no longer poisoned our society. He wanted to do all the things that his grandfather wanted to do, but his grandfather thought you could only really do that through the church, that it was something that was the mission of the church. And Rorty says, I don't care whether it's the mission of the church. That's completely irrelevant. The church doesn't have anything to say to me. And I think it's interesting to see how that kind of commitment, that Christian commitment to social transformation, I think kind of left behind over the decades the Christian part. The sense was that we still want the social transformation, but we no longer believe that religious belief is necessary to it.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go up to 2016 for just a moment and where you start your article with Donald Trump and what's happening with very conservative reactionary parties in Europe. You write early on that we really need people who understand the impulses from which these troubling movements arise, who may themselves belong in some sense to the communities driving these movements, but also a part of the liberal social order. A couple questions. Do you have an understanding of the impulses from which all of these movements are arising, and who do we need to put front and center? What we've become, and maybe it's because of television, is that here's what was said today. Here's, can you believe what was said today? This is what was said today. This is what's happening. And there is no background information to much of anything. It's just really kind of appalling. So who should be giving us that? And I don't even know how you make that happen at this point.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I mentioned J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, because I think he's an example of that kind of voice. You know, I grew up in Alabama and didn't have a completely typical upbringing for someone of my generation. For instance, we were not really a religious family. But I know that world. And, you know, I still have a lot of family back in Alabama who are going to vote for Donald Trump. And so to some extent, you know, I understand where that comes from. Mm-hmm. But as I've also said to them using a traditional Southern idiom, y'all were raised better than that. I don't think Trump is the answer to the question that they have posed and that they've rightly identified as being serious social issues. But I think there just aren't enough people going back and forth between those two worlds. And my experience there is the way that I tend to think about these things is that, you know, when I'm immersed in the world of the church, I often find people who are immensely, deeply, reflexively hostile to academics. They think of academics as their enemies. And then when I'm in the academic world, I hear academics talk much the same way about religious believers. So I've kind of spent all my life going back and forth between these two communities. And I think that's always a help. I think it helps in two ways. You're always in a position that you can aid people's understanding. You can say, doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to excuse them, the people from one community. That is, I don't tell Christian people that academics all love them, because some academics don't, and vice versa. But I can explain things a little bit. I can say to Christians, you know, not all academics are like that. Some of them, here's what they're doing, here's what they're saying. And then I can also go to academics and say, if you knew more of these Christians from the rural South or the urban South, for that matter, that's where I'm from, you know, you would hear them a little differently, and let me try to explain that to you. And I think what belonging to multiple communities is tremendously helpful, because it's challenging, because you have to do what linguists call code switching. You know, you have to be able to speak one language to one group and a different language to a different group. It's challenging, but it gives you the opportunity to be someone who can bring a little peace to a hostile situation. But I also think, and this is where I'm going to bridge to this book that I'm working on, I also think it helps you think. It really helps you to think better when you're a member of multiple communities and you can see what their assumptions are, what they believe about the world, how that gives rise to certain statements and certain practices. And then when other people don't understand that, you can say, okay, I see where the disagreement came from. And then you have to start thinking, all right, how could I make these people more understandable to one another? Not necessarily to agree, but at least to understand what their actual disagreements are, as opposed to just hostility. And that requires a lot of thought. It's training in thinking. It's training in having engaging with multiple points of view and analyzing them and seeing where they come from. And that's very useful. Mm. The problem is that most of us, I think, there's some argument about this, but I do believe that we have a tendency, that most of us have a tendency now to be in certain kinds of ideological bubbles.
Yes.
And on, especially on social media, where we only hear from people who tend to agree with what we already believe. And then when we do share what other different people believe, we tend to share the worst rather
right.
than the best.
Yeah, very interesting and very true, I think. We'll take a couple more phone calls. We're, the hour is flying by here. Alan Jacobs is our guest, has a fascinating piece in Harper's The Watchman, What Became of the Christian Intellectuals? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. DJ in Palmyra is our next caller. Hi, DJ.
Hello. Yeah, your guest briefly touched on this a moment ago, but I wondered if he could expand on it. Do you believe that the internet noise, particularly social media noise, tends to drown out intellectual voices?
I'm afraid it does. I don't want to be one of these, blame everything on social media people. And, and I use social media, and I'm, I've actually made really good friends on Twitter, and there are a lot of good things about it, but I'm not sure that people use social media in the best ways in that regard. The currency of social media is becoming viral, right? The idea of something becoming viral, the number of retweets or reposts that you have, the number of likes that you have on Facebook, and it's really, really difficult to resist the lure of that. It is a constant opportunity for social affirmation. I've pretty much completely gone off of public Twitter because I realized the extent to which I was prone to that. And you say something. I mean, we are in some ways, what Pavlov did with his dogs and what B.F. Skinner did with his Skinner boxes, these responses to positive and negative reinforcement, we're all subject to that to some extent. And so if you say something that gets 100 retweets or something like that, you're going to want to say more like that.
Yeah.
But the things that get the 100 retweets tend to be the more extreme and simplistic statements that confirm what people listening to you already believe.
DJ, thanks for the call. I want to take one more call. We only have a minute left. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Quick question. I keep reading that various polls indicates that white evangelicals, the vast majority, are supporting Donald Trump. I do not understand that. Can your guest explain?
About 45 seconds. Can you give us a rundown?
I'm not sure I can explain. First of all, my own judgment is that that's not a good idea. But I think the briefest explanation is that they are, a lot of these people who are evangelical, white evangelicals, are also people who feel that their place in society is being threatened, that they are less influential, they are less respected than they once were. And when Donald Trump says, I'll make it right, I will put you back in your proper place at the center of society, they believe him.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Alan Jacobs, for being with us. It was a great hour. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Alan Jacobs, Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the Honors Program at Baylor University. His special areas, theology and literature, the history of books and reading, and the poetry of W.H. Auden. He is currently writing a couple books, and we'll have to get him when this one is published in 2017, How to Think, A Guide for the Perplexed. He is author of a piece in the current issue of Harper's, The Watchman, What Became of the Christian Intellectuals. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio and a fascinating hour to follow. We're going to be looking at, I didn't even know about some of the drugs that are just breaking through that may have remarkable ramifications for how long we live. And then we'll ask, what are we going to do with our expected extra 100 years, huh?